If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang it in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me is a man that's only got three rules. One, turn off the lights because he hates the light. Number two, don't get him wet. And number three, whatever you do, and no matter how much he begs, don't feed him after midnight because he's the captain.
They call me the Gizmo Kid. It's good to be seen and it's good to see you.
This week's beer of the week is Sugar Shack Maple Stout by Third Street Brew House, Cold Spring, Minnesota. 3.5 bottle caps out of 5. This unique brew is enhanced with maple syrup harvested at St. John's Abbey Arboretum and Forest. And this week's beer is brought to us by our good friends Lauren in Lanesdale, Pennsylvania, Deborah in Elgin, Illinois, Deborah in Phoenix, Arizona, who says she loves treating us to a beer but wishes she was here drinking one with us in person, and Angela S. in Blacktown, Australia. Angela is a longtime listener and one of our biggest fans. Angela, to quote the captain, I like your jib.
A big shout out to Windy River and everybody that's affected by the floods in Louisiana. She sent some very kind words, and if you can donate to that cause, please do so. And everybody in Louisiana, we love your jib.
For everybody facing that tragedy, hang tight, hang in there. We're thinking about you here in the garage.
For everything True Crime Garage, go to truecrimegarage.com. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at True Crime Garage.
And make sure you go over to the YouTube page and subscribe to True Crime Garage TV and check out our new videos.
A big shout out to our man Gavin making those videos happen for us.
That's enough of the business. Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer, and let's talk some true crime.
This is True Crime Garage, and this is the case of Joshua Guimond. Every week we pick a case to cover. We have a giant master list. I'm constantly looking at it, trying to figure out what's the next interesting thing to talk about? Of course, there are some popular cases like Zodiac, ChonBenet Ramsey. But sometimes there's cases I've never heard of. We covered the West Memphis 3. And then following that, we covered the Black Dahlia. Sometimes you just don't want to talk about that stuff. Sometimes it gets too much. I'm going through the list, and I see a name that I don't recognize, a case I've never heard of. Joshua Guimond, Collegeville, Minnesota. Josh went missing in 2002. Beside Josh's name is my friend's name. She must have suggested the case. It must be the reason why I put it on the list. So I phoned a friend. I said, what do you know about Joshua? She goes, I thought you guys would never cover that case. There's not a lot of information about it. It's not that popular. She said that she saw his name on a list of missing people cases. She Googled him. An image popped up. Something about that image struck a chord. A nerve. She saved that picture on her phone. I did the same. I Googled him. It's haunting, really. This guy just went missing. Was at a party one minute and just disappears. It looks very familiar to me. It's probably because he looks a lot like my best friend from middle school and high school. We even hung out a little bit in college. And as time goes by, you lose touch. What's interesting about a missing person case, it's pretty simple. One minute they're somewhere, next minute they vanish. Joshua was age 20. He was a junior in college. St. John's, which is located in Collegeville, Minnesota. Collegeville, Minnesota doesn't get much more Norman Rockwell than that. The party was on the north end of campus and it was in the dorms. It was November 9th. It's Minnesota, so we know it's cold. It was some buddies getting together. You know, have a couple beers, play little cards, maybe smoke some cigars, talk about women. Josh walked to the party. He only lived about 3 minutes away. So Josh is at the party. They play some cards. They drink some beer. In between 11 p.m., at midnight, he's last seen. Was he stepping out for a smoke? Just to get some fresh air? Was he going to go to the restroom? Or was he leaving the party to go back to his apartment? The problem was he never returned to the party. His friends got a little worried, so they called his apartment. There was no answer, so they just assumed that Josh left the party, went back to his apartment, and fell asleep, and was either too intoxicated or too tired to answer the phone. So nothing too weird. I mean, we've all been at parties where maybe it's just not that much fun, and you just want to go home, so you just dip out. Or maybe you said bye and people just don't remember because they were drinking themselves. Either way, not much to suspect until the next day. Josh doesn't show up to a school event. This worries his friends. In a missing person case, the more twists there are, the more fascinating it is. You go down these little rabbit holes and then you start thinking about all these possibilities. It's like a thinking game, and I think that's why people like these cases so much. I just assume with Josh's case, there wasn't that many twists. He went to a party, he went missing. It was simple. And maybe that's why it's not that popular. Maybe that's why I've never heard of this. But a couple days after Josh goes missing, we get our first twist. Someone was on Josh's computer, and 300 documents go missing. Well, there's your twist. There's always more than one twist. And I'm sure there will be more. This is True Crime Garage, and this is the case of Joshua Guimon.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, I highly recommend that you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. This show is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp. Check out betterhelp.com/garage today.
The best part of spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless. When Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. It's time to switch to Mint Mobile. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. Save a lot of money with Mint Mobile. Get their great mobile wireless service delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. That's premium service at a great price. To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey, a hidden object mystery game with a captivating detective story. It takes you back to the glamour of the 1920s with a diverse cast of characters. You'll step into the role of June Parker and search for hidden clues to uncover the mystery of her sister's murder. Use your observation skills to quickly uncover key pieces of information that lead to chapters of mystery, danger, and romance. And customize your very own luxurious estate island. Think expansive gardens and beautiful buildings. Collect scraps of information to fill your photo album and learn more about each character. And you can chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
St. John's University was founded in 1857, is one of the oldest institutions of education in the Midwest, and is among the top-rated liberal arts colleges in the nation. Set amid 2,700 acres of campus, including wetlands, several lakes, and extensive pine and hardwood forest. In 2002, 20-year-old Joshua Guimond is a junior majoring in political science at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. On November 9th, Josh was with friends at a party. Sometime between the 11 o'clock hour and midnight, he was leaving Metten Court, a dormitory on the north end of St. John's campus. Josh was leaving to go to the bathroom, but when he did not return after about 15 minutes, his friends assumed that he had walked back to his apartment.
Josh lived in the campus apartments, and so he was about a three-minute walk from the party.
Yeah, he was living at the St. Moore House, which is located in the middle of campus. And in fact, after his friends last saw Josh, this was just shortly afterwards, they tried calling the apartment, but they got no answer. There is no evidence that Josh ever arrived at the apartment.
Yeah, I think they were just assuming that maybe he drank a little bit too much, or maybe he was just tired. I mean, it's a Saturday. It's November 9th. It's a Saturday. I mean, he might have had stuff he had to do. He was preparing for a school event the next day.
And some say party, but we have a lot of people have said that this was more of a low-key kind of thing, that there was not too many people there. There was only, I believe, 10 or 11 people there, and it sounded more like it was a card party.
And this is 2002. I remember a lot of my buddies starting to get really into Texas Hold'em at this point.
Oh, yeah. It was huge at the time.
Everybody was getting together, drinking beers, hanging out, playing poker, $10 buy-in, $20 buy-in. It was a good way to pass the time and spend the night hanging out with your friends.
Josh goes to this hangout party, right? Mm-hmm. And he's hanging out with his buddies. They're playing a little poker. They're drinking. He leaves. It's not that big of a deal that he just dips out. I mean, this happens all the time, especially at college parties. You kind of come and go as you please. But they kind of get worried because he doesn't say anything or they don't remember him saying bye. So they call his apartment. Again, nobody answers. Not a big deal. Again, he's just tired. It's, you know, Saturday. It's late. The following day, though, they have a school function and Josh never shows up.
Yeah, he failed to attend the school function, and it was a mock trial that he would have been involved in.
Yeah, he was a political science major, and from everything I read, it seems like he was a really good student. He's heavily involved as far as like extra school activities. I think he was part of like the Young Republicans Club. So it was odd that he missed this. That takes a little situation and makes it a bigger situation.
Yeah, everybody regards him as quite responsible and somebody that would miss something of this magnitude.
His family and friends also go on to say that he's not even the kind of person that would leave the party, just dip out. That stuff happens every now and then, but again, I think it's important that they bring up that point. He's one to say, hey guys, I'm out of here.
So his friends report him missing. His roommate actually says that he never saw Josh that night, mm-hmm. the night of the card game, and he never saw him the following day. So after Josh is reported missing, they discover that his eyeglasses, his contact lenses, his identification, and credit cards were left behind. They couldn't find any personal items that would be missing from his apartment.
It also seems like his car wasn't touched or moved from the location it was earlier that Saturday.
Yeah, the car's found undisturbed, and at the time that Josh vanished, he was not wearing clothing that would be appropriate for a November night in Minnesota.
But he only lives 3 minutes away from the party, so maybe he's wearing a hoodie, some shorts, and he just says, I'm going to swing over by, you know, this party for just a minute.
The missing posters report that Joshua was wearing a gray Gap or St. John's University hooded sweatshirt, blue jeans, and a wristwatch. Joshua Giemond is described as a Caucasian male, 20 years old, 5'10" to about 6 foot tall, 170 to 176 pounds, with blonde hair, blue eyes, and he has a medium complexion. He also has a scar on his shoulder, which is about 4 inches long.
That's pretty much a rundown of that day and that night and then the next day. And then the cops are going to get involved and his family is going to get more involved as well. As far as what happens with Josh beforehand, well, he had a girlfriend for, like we said, he was a junior in college. He had a girlfriend for about 5 years. And a month before this party, him and his girlfriend took a break. But they were really good friends. They remained in contact. I don't know if she went to school in that area or if she was further away, but it seemed like he was dealing with that situation pretty well.
So let's talk about the search for Joshua and the timeline that is involved. Now, we do know that on Sunday, he wasn't reported missing until pretty late in the day. So they did search the area, but the search was pretty minimal because they were conducting the search after dark. Now, on Monday, the following day, the entire St. John's campus and surrounding areas were searched by horse and by foot, including buildings, the power plant, and all the wooded areas. Divers from the Stearns County Sheriff's Department searched the campus area, and a dog led them to a water area.
And I think this dog leading the police to this water area started this theory that Joshua was just maybe intoxicated, left the party, and then stumbled into a body of water.
And the body of water that we're talking about would have been located between where he was last seen, leaving the card party, walking home towards his apartment.
Police do several searches in different bodies of water, and we'll go into that more in detail, but nothing was found.
No, and also on that Monday, the Minnesota State Patrol aided in the search by sending helicopters to do an aerial search of the woods and around the campus. On Tuesday, November 12th, campus buildings continued to be searched, and on Wednesday, November 13th, the Minnesota National Guard stepped in to aid in the search, providing 118 troops and equipment and searching 16 square mile area around the campus. This included swamps and woods.
But this campus is 2,700 acres. So, I mean, yeah, they got a little task force out, but it's still trying to find a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, it's 2,700 acres, and we have a lot of area that's covered in woods. We have some swamps that we mentioned, and also lots of water. The body of water that the captain had referred to earlier is known as Stumpf Lake. This is a snake-like body of water located en route that Joshua would have taken to back to his apartment. The decision was made to lower the water level in order to search the lake. Now, dragging the lake and searching it uncovered no clues.
And obviously, during the search, his family and friends are way more involved than they were earlier, but now the father is involved.
Yeah, so on Thursday, Brian Guimond, he's the father, he attended a meeting and a press conference at the state capitol for families of three other missing students, and he met the Jenkins family, who would later help the Guimond family in their search for Joshua.
So this is where we get another twist. This school doesn't have a problem with one kid going missing. They have a problem with now three kids going missing.
Well, it's the area. It's more of an area rather than just the one school. But who is the Jenkins family? The Jenkins family, they're the family of Christopher Jenkins, who is a 21-year-old who was last seen October 31st, 2002, he was leaving a Halloween party at a bar in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Now, this is a case that I've heard about a lot with the Brian Schaefer case. When we covered the Brian Schaefer case, Chris Jenkins case is a case that people said over time and time again, this seems so similar. And Chris was at a Halloween party, which I just think that makes it way creepier.
Yeah, and you're talking about two kids about the same age going missing almost at the exact same time. This is only 9 or 10 days apart from one another in the same state. And I don't think that Christopher Jenkins was a college student. He's often referred to as a college-aged man, so we're not certain if he was attending school, but the area that he went missing from is approximately about an hour's drive from where Joshua was last seen.
Yeah, and what I was saying by the school has a problem with three kids going missing, it's not three students going missing, but it's just bad for business. When there's publicity of, you know, college-age students going missing from around your area, it's bad for enrollment.
This would bring us to November 24th, 2002. There is a search that is organized by the Guimond family that involves 75 to 100 volunteers. Now, some of these people are from out of town. They get together and they comb the woods around the St. John's campus. And there's also a search again of that Stumpf Lake. This time they are using sonar technology. Now, this is again unsuccessful in yielding any evidence in the disappearance. The first week of December of the same year, the Stearns County Sheriff's Department, they get together and they start questioning the nine students that were present at the card party the night that Joshua disappeared.
Which goes with our speculation that it wasn't like this big party. Like, I don't know if that's the right term for this. This was a
get together.
Right.
This was a couple guys getting together, having beers, playing cards, maybe betting a little money, having a good time. And they're able to question eight of those nine students. Now, however, they were unable to contact the remaining students.
So you got a kid going missing and you just can't find one of them. It's not that many people. It's not that many people that you need to talk to.
Yeah, and not only that, we're talking about like 3.5-4 weeks later that we're able to round up these students and talk to them. I know there's a break in there for Thanksgiving. You know, I'm assuming the students may have gone home to see their families.
Yeah, but you're not a huge school. This is a huge problem. This is at least a statewide issue as far as what's going to be coming out in the newspapers.
Not only that, on the Monday after Joshua went missing, Joshua's roommate tells the police that the last time I saw him was around 8:30 the night he went missing. He left to go to a card party. So they know within 2 days of where he was and who he last saw. And yeah, it's just shocking to me that we're taking our time, sitting on our hands. Now, I shouldn't say sitting on our hands because they were searching the campus. But
what's interesting is that 8:30, he leaves his apartment with it, and his roommate claims he sees him about 8:30. He leaves. So probably about 8:35, 8:40, he's arriving at this little card gathering.
Mm-hmm.
Less than a couple hours later, he's leaving.
Yeah.
So maybe he just ran out of money. Maybe he's just not that interested in cards.
Sometimes you lose, though. You know what I mean?
Right,
like, there's nothing more frustrating if you're, you know, especially at that time, everybody was playing Texas Hold'em. A lot of people were playing poker. I'm just assuming they were playing poker. But I know times that I get my butt kicked or I lose, you know, after a couple hours. They could have been playing euchre. But some people were competitive. And when I lose, sometimes I go home. Sometimes I go home right afterwards.
Yeah, I'd send you home.
Now, the investigators bring in a bloodhound. They're going to try to track Joshua's scent and mm-hmm. see where they, you know, see what his movements were, because we have no idea where he is.
Well, they already did this once, but it went to the lake.
Yeah, and this time on December 29th, Hoover, the bloodhound, he follows Joshua's scent from Metton Court, where he was last seen, right. to that Stumpf Lake that we had talked about. And then he follows the scent further to Joshua's apartment at St. Maur's. And then from there, he takes them to St. John's Abbey.
Okay.
The search is then halted. The dog is blocked from entering St. John's Abbey.
And we just happen to be at marker 666 right now, which is pretty odd, because we're going to start talking about the church that is connected, the monastery that's connected to St. John's University. So they're going to follow the scent to this lake and then to his apartment, but then from the apartment to a monastery.
Yeah, which is a very large building.
And they're stopped. So you're trying to find this missing student, and the university is stopping you. To me, that is shady Shadesville.
Is it the university or is it the monastery? Because I believe that while they are operating together in some fashion, that they may actually be somewhat separate entities.
Right, right.
Even though that they belong together. And I don't know.
Yeah,
that
normally like the dean and stuff has no say over the monastery, and the monastery probably has no say over the university.
And this is an old prestigious thing. I don't mm-hmm. know that this is a building that the general public is welcomed into often, if ever.
Yeah, well, but when you have a sniffing dog and some police officers, you would think, but maybe not so much.
Well, not only that, we're tied to this school, okay? And this school in this whole thing is a community, right? It's mm-hmm. a community of people living amongst one another, mm-hmm. Some there for education, whether it be religious or just working to get a job or to get a degree in some fashion.
Right.
And now we are halting this investigation. We're stopping you. We're closing our doors because maybe you've knocked on the wrong door. Maybe you've knocked on the right door. Maybe you've knocked on a door that we don't want you to knock on.
Right.
And we're just not going to let anybody in here. And
well, the problem, though, is a lot of times religion goes above the law. And that's the big issue. You know, it's supposed to be separation of church and state and all that bullshit. That normally doesn't happen. We normally, for some reason in this country, we hold religion higher than law.
Well, and I think a big problem with this case is that that's exactly the fact in this community that we just discussed. I think that the religion there is the law. On January 5th, 2003... Now, they're going to open up their doors, and they're going to let the investigators, along with, again, Hoover, he's the bloodhound that they've put in charge of finding Joshua's scent. He traces Joshua's scent to the back of, which is a very large building, the monastery there, and then he follows that scent again to the lake behind the monastery.
So now that I had a chance to clean up my monastery, get rid of all the evidence. Oh, come on in. Check everything out. Everything's fine.
Well, on January 8th, the Stearns County Sheriff's Department would send divers into multiple bodies of water on the campus. Now, one of them that they didn't send any divers into is the
is the one that the monastery said, don't look into that one.
Yeah, they ended up using only underwater cameras. But this, again, we find no evidence of Joshua, nothing to you know, give us any clues as to why he disappeared.
But what if we go with the scent, then we can assume that he went from the party, walked around the lake, went to his apartment, and then went to the monastery.
If we're going to believe Hoover the Bloodhound, mm-hmm. then that's where the trail takes us.
A stand-up gentleman. So when we left off, we're talking about the hound dog Hoover, and he followed this track. Now, there are some rumors, because this is not actual police dog, right?
Correct.
This is from like
an outside agency.
Yeah, you call up and say, we want a sniffing dog, and they brought in Hoover. And so there are some rumors that he's just not cracked up, you know, he's not fit.
Some people in the area are attacking his credibility of the search dog Hoover.
Well, and a lot of people said that, you know, Hoover had a drinking problem.
Well, and you know, with these, as far as the scent tracing dogs, you know, we've often heard mm-hmm. that their credibility is brought into check at times. You know, we've heard things like the dog is only as good as the handler, or the handler is only as good as the dog. Now, we don't know in this situation. What we do know is that on more than one occasion, this dog has followed the same trace. He's traced the same areas.
Mm-hmm.
But now keep in mind, we're talking about searches that are conducted a month after the fact, 2 months after the fact.
And we have the monastery and the college kind of impeding on this investigation. And I find that just very odd.
Well, and to furthermore that thought, January 18th, 2003, the searchers are asked to stop searching with the scent tracing dog Hoover. And the campus is saying that pets are not allowed on campus.
See, you know, this is what seems ridiculous to me. Like, pets aren't allowed on campus, but we have a missing person that we're looking for.
Well, what St. John's is going to say is that they don't mind. They're not trying to stop the searches. They're not trying to stop the investigation for Josh. What they're saying is that they only want to have searches that are conducted and coordinated through the Stearns County Sheriff's Department.
And obviously this becomes an issue for Brian, Josh's dad, because again, it makes it seem like they're tying your hands behind your back and you're trying to find answers to what happened to your son.
In the middle of January 2003, the Gimon family is notified that private searches can be conducted as long as the abbot is notified prior to the event and the Stearns County Sheriff's Department approves of the action.
I think a lot of this is to, you know, you have an image to uphold, for one, and, it, you know, college is a business. You need to get students coming in. So maybe the searches are just taking place too often and just kind of sporadic, and it's causing too much of a scene.
And at the same time, this is when they allow the searchers to return, and they bring, again with them, Hoover, and they are searching the perimeter around the lake that is behind the monastery. Now, this is middle of January, so they are going to have to use drills to drill holes in the ice, and they use cameras, and they're dipping them down into the water, trying to see if they can see anything. Now, they don't find anything with using these cameras or having the dog sniff around the perimeter. February 27, 2003, this is when they're going to find the body of Christopher Jenkins in the Mississippi River.
And now, we did make a mistake because we said he was just college age, but he actually was a college student.
Yeah, he was attending the University of Minnesota. A private investigator used bloodhounds in the search for Christopher Jenkins when they were conducting their investigation. Mm-hmm. Now, what they found on two separate occasions using two different dogs, both dogs had traced Chris's scent from the bar that he had left. He left the Lone Tree Bar and Grill.
Mm-hmm.
They followed his scent from that bar and grill to a underground parking garage that was nearby, and to some specific parking stalls. And this all indicated that Jenkins probably got into a car. Now, they think that the car would have headed west on I-94.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Jenkins, his cause of death is listed as an apparent drowning. On that same day, they were, in private investigators as well as the Gimon family, along with volunteers, were trying to conduct another search in the St. John's University campus.
Yep. Okay.
Now, they ran into troubles, though, because they wanted to search an area that included two boathouses. Now, this is another area that was led to them by the dog. The problem with this is when they arrive to conduct this search, a Stearns County Sheriff's Department captain, he states that a search warrant is required to search the boathouses. So, again, the search is stopped. Now, Brian Guimond...
One of the reasons they're doing that, though, is because if they find any evidence, that can be tossed out in court later.
You're exactly right. But Brian Guimond, the father of Joshua, would say that we notified the sheriff's department prior to searching this area. There's no reason why they should have halted this search.
Well, there's no reason that they couldn't have got a search warrant.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, we won't continue down the entire road of the timeline regarding the year of 2003, because what we see for the remainder of the year is attempts at searching the campus area and searching those waterways. Now, what happens is on occasion they are granted permission and they do search the water and they search the lakes. And again and again, nothing turns up. They find no evidence of anything.
And when somebody goes missing, we got to think about all the options, right? Is he running away to start a new life? Did he go somewhere to commit suicide? Is this foul play? It seems like in Josh's life, as far as before this, I mean, he seems like he's pretty driven. He seems like he's very likable. He has friends. It doesn't seem like there's much motivation for suicide at all.
No, there didn't seem to be much speculation regarding suicide at all from the get-go.
And again, he did have that girlfriend that he dated for a really long time, 5 years, but it seemed like they were friends. But again, you can't rule that out on the possibility that he was drinking, maybe starts reminiscing. Maybe there's something there. Maybe there's some information that I wasn't able to uncover. I don't think you uncovered. So let's kind of just say that as far as going down that rabbit hole, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and there's not a lot of evidence pointing towards that.
Definitely, and actually the thing that I think points that out the most is that in the very beginning of this disappearance, what everybody was thinking happened, including campus officials, including the sheriff's department, including his father and family, the original thought was maybe this was an accidental death and that they were checking those water, you know, the water areas,
right?
Because they thought maybe he had fallen into something or if he was met with foul play, that's where he would be found. Now, time and time again, he's not found, obviously, but furthermore, yeah. to even speculate at some point, you got to rule out maybe even an accidental death because involving the water anyway, because they've searched these things time and time again, and they're not even turning up bits of clothing or anything that would suggest that he was in that water. His family to this day firmly believe that he was met with foul play or some type of abduction situation because they never found any of that evidence on campus. They never found any of that clothing. And again, his personal belongings were all left behind.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that he ran away to start a new life.
Yeah, unless he's just leaving in a pair of jeans, a hoodie, and a wristwatch.
Right.
And he's just going to up and leave town.
Going for broke.
I mean, but
doesn't make a lot of sense. There's not a lot of logic based in that thought process.
Didn't take his car, and nobody suggested that he picked up a bus pass or a plane ticket or any of those items.
So what we're down to now, though, is basically foul play or accidental death. And the problem I have with the accidental death is, one, there's a lot of acreage. There's a lot of woodsland. There's a lot of waterways. It's possible that I know that you're doing a lot of in-depth searches, but it's possible that you just didn't find something, or that, you know, he floated further downstream or whatever.
It is possible, but what is likely? I think what is more likely, I think that the family is probably right here. I think what you're looking at is a possible abduction situation. Maybe he ended up going with somebody that played a bad trick on him, or maybe he got into a car or was picked up by somebody. We just don't know. And like you said, yeah, 2,700 acres. Yeah, that's a big area. And we have swamps, we have wetlands, we have woods, we have water. But the thing is, we talk about time and time again, multiple searches are conducted. At one point, the state brings in people, and there's 118 officers in the area combing the woods.
Again, but that's a lot of acreage to cover, even though that's a lot of people.
Yeah, but on separate occasions, we have volunteer searchers of upwards of 75 to 100 people searching the area. We have people using technology to search the water. There's just, you know, in the buildings, there's really no trace of Josh.
Yeah, and so like we mentioned a while back, and we haven't really touched on it, was a couple days afterwards, somebody accessed Josh's computer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of speculation here. So one, did somebody break into the computer? Was it possibly Josh? But there was documents that were deleted from his computer. They believe possibly done by his roommate. And there are 300 documents, and these were all related to fake ID, like a fake ID ring. Okay. They claim that Josh wasn't involved in this, but again, the documents are on your computer, so I don't know how you're not involved.
Well, and he's 20 years old. He's not of legal drinking age. Uh-huh. His friends are probably all similar in age. We all know that people drink when they go to college, whether they're of age or not. And furthermore, we all know that there are fake IDs. You know, people use these fake IDs when they're 19, 20 years old to get into certain parties, to get into certain bars or clubs or just make purchases.
What I think is probably more likely in this case is that once he goes missing and once they're searching the apartment and searching other things, is that if his roommate or friends were involved and they were running this off of his computer, well, let's get rid of this evidence, one, to save our butts, but also to, you know, we don't want to tarnish our buddy's name even further.
Yeah, I mean, Josh was probably a stand-up guy, and from what everybody says, family and friends-wise, people on campus, he was every bit of that, a stand-up guy. And like you said, maybe the roommate was doing his old buddy a favor or one of his friends doing him a favor, that there was something on his computer that he was either involved in or not, and we're going to wipe it clean to not tarnish his name. You know, because
it still just comes across as kind of fishy, you know.
It is fishy. But again, we don't know exactly what those documents were. We don't know, would it help or hinder the investigation of his disappearance? We said that Josh was a political science major at the university. Now, his friends say that he was hoping to become a lawyer and that one day Josh wanted to serve in the Minnesota House of Representatives. It's also been discussed that Joshua had on several occasions been a bit outspoken in his criticism of the abuse scandals that plagued the St. John's University in Abby.
So St. John's being a Catholic church or Catholic school, and then you got the monastery, they're having these charges. And when you say abuse, these are sexual abuse charges.
Well, throughout the years, there's been lots of allegations, let's say, rather than charges.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been allegations of misconduct. And sometimes this is sexual misconduct as well, whether it be perpetrated by either a teacher or a priest or one of the monks. But there's been a lot of allegations over the years involving several different people employed or a part of the monastery or the school.
It's not uncommon to have these claims against a school or a church, but we do know from recent history about all the claims that have come out against the Catholic Church.
To go along with these different allegations of misconduct, some sexual misconduct involving the St. John's University or the monastery, we have something that happened pretty recently. Now, this is Sunday, January 24th, 2016. Reverend Dan Ward, he is confronted after a presentation that he gives. He gave a presentation to an audience of 50 to 75 people on the campus of St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. Now, one of Father Ward's alleged victims attended this presentation.
Mm.
Father Ward admitted to the audience that he had met with the alleged victim in the vice president's office. He admits to this after the presentation. So after the presentation, Father Ward takes questions. The first person to take the microphone, they ask if Father Ward had ever crossed student-teacher boundary lines and with any student or students from St. John's Prep School or St. John's University.
Now, can you imagine being a fly on a wall here, right? He gives this presentation, and then you got an accuser in the audience, and then the first question is just a bombshell.
Yeah, have you ever crossed that student-teacher boundary?
I'd probably be in the back going, awkward.
And the young lady asking this question, she's pretty thorough because, you know, she says, did you ever cross student-teacher boundary lines with any students from St. John's Prep School, St. John's University, or any of the novice monks? Father Ward, he answers no. Well, she goes on to ask about a mock trial program and ask about Joshua Guimond.
Yeah.
Father Dan Ward responded.
Now, let's just go back so we know the importance of this. A mock trial or debate. This is the event that he does not show up for the next day.
Something that Joshua was involved in. Father Dan Ward, during this interaction, he responds immediately saying that he was in the Bahamas when Guimond was at St. John's.
So Joshua is a junior, so for the 3 years, you never go back to St. John's. Never, ever.
His short and simple answer was that while Joshua was at St. John's, that Father Ward was in the Bahamas. Right after Guimond's name is brought up,
all right,
Abbot Klessen, he's in charge, okay? So he allowed Father Ward to answer questions and allegations about sexual misconduct.
Which is weird anyways, because you think they would have just stopped that right there.
But after Josh's name is brought up, he
does answer a question about him. He says, I was in the Bahamas. But then, right after that...
Well, another person there asking questions is asking the father if he was ever involved in mock trial. And he said, yes, him and another priest or another teacher there, they were in charge of the mock trial.
Right.
At one point in his career. Now, the person asking the questions would bring up that Joshua was a co-captain during these mock trials. And immediately, this is when Abbot Klessen takes over and says, you know what, I don't think that this is the time or the place to address this issue.
All right, so basically what we have is we have, asking questions about Josh. And then basically saying, look, I was in the Bahamas. But then somebody basically connects the dots. You were the leader of this debate thing, and Josh was one of the captains.
Well,
so there is your connection.
They might be insinuating that, but what I think is tricky here is that maybe the timelines aren't adding up. You know, just because he was involved with the mock trial at some point, while being present at St. John's, does not mean that he was there for that same time period of November 2002. Now, but the
yeah,
thing,
but then it does seem really fishy. Then we let you answer all these other inappropriate questions
for this
forum, but now we're stopping you. Once they're connecting some dots, now we're stopping you.
Well, not only that, what's even more strange, Captain, is that Father Ward is allowed to be backed in a corner. You know, this Abbot Klessen, he doesn't get involved and break up the discussion until Josh's name is brought up, which is strange because, like I said, Father Ward was backed into a corner. The first young lady that was asking him questions, that was talking to him, she said something about, didn't you ask me to forgive you when we were in the vice principal's office, when you did something? And then didn't you ask me to forgive you?
Right.
And Father Ward says, no, I never asked you to forgive me. He does admit to being in the vice principal's office with this young lady, but he says that he's not willing to discuss something that has already been settled.
Right. The details of whatever matter they're talking about.
So I don't understand here. We have a guy in charge who clearly can take the microphone and can take over the presentation at any point and and call the shots.
Right.
But he allows Father Ward to be backed in a corner by this person with the questions. And then he calls off the, you know, as soon as Josh's name is brought up, he calls off the questions.
Well, that's his job. But what's interesting to me is what if this guy knows about some shady stuff that was going down? And he's like, you know what? I just want him to feel the heat a little bit. A lot of priests, a lot of teachers, a lot of people have been accused of these kind of crimes. And there's normally no justice for the victims. That's normally how this stuff goes. Oh, we got a priest and they're molesting somebody and we're just going to move them. We don't want to talk about it. We're just going to move them from one church to another. Look, all those scandals that came up, those priests didn't face criminal charges. They did criminal activities. They did not face criminal charges. And that's injustice, that the fact that we're not screaming for their heads. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Now, I want to be absolutely clear here. I'm not saying or suggesting that Father Dan Ward, had anything to do with the disappearance of Josh. What I'm saying is that whether it be Father Ward or other persons at St. John's University, there was clearly something going on at the time beforehand, and Josh knew about some of this, whether it be firsthand accounts or hearing it from other students. You know, we had heard that he was a bit outspoken about some of these allegations of misconduct that were rumors throughout the school. There was something going on here, and whether it be involving the priest or professors or the monks, but it was going on within the university.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is, like the captain said, you know, a lot of times with these churches, when something's going down, there's no criminal charges brought against these people. They're just moved, and it's kind of swept under the rug, right? And I've always wondered, what is the... How do they come up with that? How do they justify that that's the right thing to do in those situations?
Because it's the right thing for their organization.
It's the right thing for the organization. But you know, I always wondered, is it because that, you know, Jesus was teaching us to forgive one another, right? And mm-hmm. God is we're taught God is a forgiver.
Maybe that's what they're thinking, but that's...
Well, certainly within the Catholic religion, mm-hmm. that's what people are taught. And are they saying that, you know what, we will forgive our fellow man? We're taught to forgive our fellow man. So they're going to forgive somebody within their organization and sweep it under the rug and pretend like it never happened. The problem here, though, is something horrible happened on their campus. This wasn't just a fellow man somewhere that you need to forgive for crimes that you don't know anything about. This involved one of your own. This was a person that was on your campus, that lived on your campus, mm-hmm. the student. This is Josh that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. That he was a part of your community. And where maybe you were taught to forgive and to forget and turn the cheek with people that you work with or people that you know about. Here's the big problem. You're turning away a person and persons involved in your community when you stopped some of those searches and when you stopped allowing questions to be asked in certain situations regarding Josh. You can't turn the cheek with one thing and just not let people be people and not let people in your community carry on.
Well, and it's not that far-fetched to think that a church organization would cover up, if they're willing to cover up people being molested, raped, if they're willing to cover that up, then you're going to put it past them to not cover up a murder?
But the problem here, Captain, is that what I wanted to see is I wanted to see the school, the university, and the church open up its books, open up its doors, and reveal everything, you know, mm-hmm. and assist in this investigation and try to bring some closure to the, you know, let's help find this young man or bring closure to the family of the young man, whether it be if they're going to find anything or not, so that even if they don't find something, they could move on and pursue looking elsewhere.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because we have to play devil's advocate, you know, pardon the pun, I guess. because we don't really know the situation. We're outsiders looking in. Mm-hmm. We're looking at these. There's constant records of them searching. It is possible that the campus and the monastery, I mean, it looks like there's some shady stuff going on, but they did allow people to search. They allowed multiple search parties. We talked about all the searches that no evidence was found.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe at some point they just thought, look, this is more of a distraction than anything. We have to move forward. So, you know, I don't want to harp on them too much, but at the same time, we don't have any answers, and it didn't seem like they were helping too much with those.
Yeah, and it appears to me that maybe this is not an isolated incident, that this may be not just a problem that's a problem for St. John's regarding Josh's disappearance, but we also have the case of Christopher Jenkins.
Yeah, and we talked about Christopher Jenkins' trail, right? Mm-hmm. And we talk about how it goes to this underground parking garage. There is some speculation that his trail, ascent trail, can follow him all the way back to St. John's Monastery. Yes. Now, that is pure speculation. I couldn't find any evidence to back up this claim.
Me too.
But this claim happens over and over. And if this is the case, now we have a larger problem, not in just that area, but just a larger problem in general for St. John's and the monastery.
Yeah, well, and Christopher Jenkins went missing from Minneapolis. So, and we also have, we've seen this on other college campuses. You know, we've talked about it on our show before regarding Brian Schaefer, we talked about it a little bit with Joey LeBuke, but, you know, he wasn't college age.
But it's a little different because it's not that, you know, Brian was in a bar. Joey was in a bar. This guy is coming from the dorms.
Yeah, he's coming from one dorm to another dorm.
Right. I think if it was a little off campus, I would say, well, maybe the campus doesn't have much of a problem. But, I mean, any college that you go to, the college I went to, it was a nice campus. And the surrounding areas weren't so great. But you felt safe on campus. I'm assuming that the enrollment in St. John's, it's a pretty penny. You should feel safe. And it's hard to feel safe when you have an individual that's not a small guy, 5'10 to 6 foot, 170, 180 pounds, just goes missing. Like, how are you supposed to feel safe in that environment?
Yeah, and the crazy thing, though, Captain, is like we said, Christopher Jenkins goes missing Halloween 2002. We have Josh who goes missing just less than 2 weeks later.
Right.
We had Chad Sharon.
Wait, and then we have the speculation that Jenkins' trail goes all the way back to where Josh goes missing from.
We also have University of Minnesota student Chad Sharon, who went missing December 12, 2002. Now, this is just a month after Josh goes missing. Now, Chad is found February 12, 2003 in the St. Joseph River. And again, seeing the cause of death is apparent drown. Now, we also have Christopher Norby, who he was a former student of Minnesota who went missing the year before. This would be November 7th, 2001. He went missing from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So a year and 2 days later.
Yeah. Well, a year and 2 days earlier.
Right, right.
He goes missing from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and he's found February 11th, 2002 in the Mississippi River.
Right, accidental drowning.
Exactly. And we had talked about in the Brian Schaefer case, the what is known as the smiley face killer theory.
Right.
Now, for those of you that are not familiar, this involves many young men attending university or on campus areas having gone missing and then later found in water with tags near where they believe they could have gone into the water.
And all these people, all these victims. So here's what's interesting. So they put a group of people and they say all these guys went missing. All these college students went missing. Some of them have been found. Some of them have not been found. The ones that have been found in bodies of water. Okay, so that's where we're at. Of the bodies found, police, law enforcement have only claimed one to be of foul play. All the other ones, they think, are accidental drowning. Well, that's a lot of kids going missing. That's a lot of kids sipping on grandpa's cough medicine and going into the river.
And these, in most of these cases, we're talking about white young men attending college in the Midwest area.
Right. You know, we normally see privileged schools.
We're already seeing four cases of this in Minnesota that we just discussed tonight.
Right. We're talking about four cases within 2 years or a year.
In a short time period. And there were also cases in the state of Illinois, Indiana,
Ohio,
Wisconsin. I think there were several.
Right.
But
what I'm saying is, so one was claimed possible foul play. Then the second one that at first was ruled an accidental drowning was the Jenkins case. They have now thought that it's possible that there was foul play on that. So, I mean, yeah, people need to start waking up to this idea. I'm not 100% sold on this smiley face killer theory, but there's a lot of information out there. And if it keeps piling up, when does it just stop being a coincidence?
Well, and I'm not fully sold on it either, because we're talking about so many people over such a vast area of land, a stretch of land, and a significant stretch of time period as well. But the problem I have here, the reason why I return to this theory in this situation, is we're seeing, again, it's
within 2 weeks, two kids go missing.
Within 2 weeks. Within a year and a month, four go missing within an hour and 15 minutes of one another.
Right.
And three of them are found in water. One of them's never found. It's very strange. It's very strange.
At the end of the day, with the missing person cases, you just find all these little tiny twists. A lot of things that don't sit well with you. And I just feel like it. Diving into these cases always just leads me with more questions. What happened here? What happened here? Why was this person involved? Was this person involved? Was this just purely speculation? And that's kind of what bothers me about this these kind of cases. But it's also what fascinates me about them, because there are so many possibilities. And like I said, it's kind of a think tank.
Well, and it's going to leave you with that, because in all of, well, almost all of these situations, we have a similar story where it's somebody that's with a group of people, and then at some point they leave and they go off on their own. And we assume that they're on their own for minutes or an hour or however long it is, and then they're never seen again. Or they wash up somewhere months or a year later, and they're found somewhere. And it's all those little minutes of when they left that we don't know about. What happened? Were they alone? Yeah, was it an accident?
Right, like a lost weekend.
All right, Captain, give me your final thoughts on this matter.
What's really frustrating to me in this case, and in so many cases with the abuse scandals, is they're protecting criminals. They're protecting predators. They're protecting monsters. You got to stop that. If your entity is to show the goodness of the Lord, then you're enabling monsters. You are enabling the devil's work. So that shit needs to stop, period.
Well, church, school, and community is supposed to bring people together. This kind of behavior does not bring people together. It turns people away.
Well, not only does it turn people away, it torments people. And then also, these monsters create new monsters. I mean, it's proven time and time again that people that are molested, people that have sexual abuse, then turn to this and they abuse others. It's shown time and time again. And so this stuff needs to just fucking stop, you know, and preach the good word and all that stuff. But this stuff, by protecting these priests and these people in power, you're not doing the God's work. You're doing the devil's work. And that's what I believe on that. On this case, I really want to dive into more information on if the cases are linked. I understand that Josh and Chris went missing within about 2 weeks or 9 days, but are there more connections that we're missing? And I think if you can find those connections, I think you could put more pressure on, look, not only are they connected, but they're all connected to the school.
Yeah, and I think I'm with Brian Guimond here, with Josh's father. I agree with the family. I think that this is probably an abduction type situation, and not a vanishing. I don't think that
there's just zero evidence.
I don't think that. Yeah, I don't think that Josh chose to disappear. I think that I think that their searches were very much warranted, and they were going to go as far as they could to try to find their loved one. And I'm with the family here. I believe that we have an abduction type situation. I don't know if Josh got into a car or went along with somebody, but
well, you got to applaud his father's effort. You know, he was relentless, and that's what you have to be. And I think a lot of times the authorities, you know, the law enforcement, they do help, but in some cases, sometimes they just stop you, and it doesn't ever seem like they're doing enough. And when your kid goes missing, of course, you're going to think that nobody's doing enough. But I think in this case, he had a lot of tenacity, and I think that's something he should be proud of.
You're exactly right, because at times law enforcement was helping the family and helping the searchers, and at times the school was helping, and at times the school was not helping, and at times the law enforcement was not helping either. But he didn't stop, and I bet you he's not stopped to this day.
And all the armchair detectives out there, this is a case that you can dive into. It's hard to find information. It's hard to find out if the information that you're finding is factual. So if you want to go to our website, truecrimegarage.com, we'll have a blog post. And, any theories or leads or anything.
Feel free to post some links on there. I mean, I'm sure that there's some more stuff out there about the school or about the church that we could dive into that we just don't, we've exhausted all leads at this point. But there are allegations out there of misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
Are those involved? We don't know. But is it a coincidence that these things are happening about the same time? We don't know.
And like I said in the trailer, though, sometimes what bothers me is that there are certain cases that are very popular that people spend a lot of time on. And those, not always, but sometimes by these armchair detectives, by people like me and you talking about this stuff, they're generate new leads. And so I think sometimes when you hear about a case like this, it's an interesting case. But maybe we can see something that they haven't seen before.
Well, and Joshua Guimond, from what we know about him, he sounds like he was a young man that was in pursuit of big dreams. He had his whole life ahead of him, and unfortunately, he's disappeared, and there's no trace. And furthermore, there's not even a very big digital footprint for this young man. You know, like the captain had said, a lot of times with these cases, you can find things on YouTube. You can find things on the internet. There's not a lot of talk about Joshua's case. Now, what we can do is we can use this episode, this podcast tonight, as a kicking off point. And you can go to truecrimegarage.com. We'll have the blog on there. And let's hear your theories, and let's create a bigger, larger digital footprint for Josh and for his family. And let's not let this case go cold.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, that's one of the reasons why we're fascinated by missing person cases, but one of the main reasons why we do them is to bring light to the case and try to create some awareness. And he's been missing for a long time, and it would be nice for his family to get some answers. Do we have any recommended reading for the week?
This week's recommended reading is Our Guys by Bernard Lefkowitz. This is a true story about a group of teenage boys who lure a mentally challenged girl into a basement in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, and they commit a horrible crime in this basement. Now, some of these boys were high school boys, and they were popular boys. Some of them were student athletes, and they were well known throughout the community of Glen Ridge. This book dives into that crime and what made these young boys capable of committing such a horrible crime. If If you want to pick this book up, I recommend going to our website, truecrimegarage.com. Click on the recommended page. You can click on the Amazon banner and pick it up through our website. It helps out the show.
For everything true crime, go to truecrimegarage.com. Make sure you sign up on that mailing list.
And until next time, be good, be kind, and don't litter.